during critical conversations about climate change, who deserves a seat at the table? The 26th United Nations Climate Change Conference of Parties, or COP26, was held at Glasgow, Scotland from October the 31st to November the 12th. The conference aimed to discuss strategies in mitigating the rising global temperature, adapting to protect communities and natural habitats, mobilizing climate financing, and collaborating to deliver impactful results. The Philippine delegation at COP26 pledged to impede deforestation by 2030, presented a sustainable finance roadmap, and contributed to the revisions made in the Santiago Network. While almost 200 state representatives entered deliberations to settle a critical climate deal, youth activists were among those who protested on the streets of Glasgow, accusing COP26 of being a failed climate talk, filled with empty promises from the biggest contributors. The active participation of the youth at COP26 amplifies the importance of climate action to the younger generations as major stakeholders in the matter. Along with other developing nations, the Philippines is at great risk if concrete actions are not taken sooner. As witnesses to recurring natural disasters, Filipino youth climate activists continue to emphasize the urgency of climate action as climate change continues to negatively affect our country. Youth-driven organizations such as Kids for Kids Philippines, or KFK, serves as a platform to empower the youth and impact change through local initiatives focused on environmental protection, awareness, and climate action. Welcome to On Point, the Guidon's podcast arm where we sit down and talk with the experts on issues in and beyond Leola. Today, we will be talking to the co-founders of KFK Philippines and COP26 delegates, Natasha Tanhutko and Isabella Tanhutko. As their mission expanded beyond KFK, they also founded change agency Tayo, which generates sustainable and creative innovations for the people and planet. With their experience as COP26 delegates, we will discuss the role of the Filipino youth in climate action and the relevance of their voice in securing the future of our planet. I'm Alia Tuprio. Let's go On Point.
You started off with small outreach activities to establishing a strong community of partners and volunteers around the country that share the same mission. The development of your wide and significant reach takes drive and determination. So what inspired you to advocate for climate action?
Well, actually, we started first advocating for social justice because it's only later on that we realized that these two are intersectional. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel it. So I definitely feel like the first thing that we kind of were inspired by was even before we got into the understanding of what climate and social action was at a young age, we were greatly exposed to the idea of culture.
Yeah, so basically, as I mentioned, because we first started off with going together with our mom because she used to teach art therapy to abuse kids. And so at the age of 9 and 10, we would accompany her like after school, I think. And this had a really great influence on us growing up, especially being influenced a lot by design and culture and using that as a driver in order to create change. And so when we first got into school, like traditional school, the outreach programs that they had were graded and it was very kind of stiff in a way. And it really did not encourage the students at all to more or less give back or have this innate compassionate will to do something for others because it was more seen as homework. And we didn't really like that approach because, again, we were thinking like, okay, how are we going to close the social disparities within the social classes, especially that, you know, just enhances like the situation of poverty and everything like that. If in the education system, it's really not friendly, the approach to giving back. And we found this very important. So that's how we started Kids for Kids, not really as an organization at all. Like we had no agenda to start an organization. It was really just an after school thing that we did with their friends. We'd go to different communities and actually learn their names, you know, their favorite colors, what they love doing, actually not seeing them as a beneficiary, but more as friends. And that really helped because it also fostered friendships, you know, with our friends and like these communities. And that's how we kind of really got to know them and really got the experience, the change that we really wanted to make. And
it just so happened that a lot of other kids liked this kind of approach, that it was very casual, it was very friendly, and we used a lot of passion. So we asked our friends like what they're passionate about, whether it be football or event planning even, or mural painting. And so that's what we did with the communities. And so it was just using your passions to benefit another person. And I guess a lot of people liked that approach because it was fun. And that's what we really wanted to do. We wanted to make giving back fun for the youth. And so that's how more or less Kids for Kids started.
And then when it comes to climate action specifically, at a young age, we were always told to be aware of our surroundings. And I think we grew up in an environment that really promoted the value of our natural world. And so we are always so used to just being a part and understanding how we were interconnected with nature. And so I guess naturally when we started doing Kids for Kids and planning events, and when we were seeing that so many young people started wanting to understand what exactly climate change was, since it's not something that's generally new, it's a term that already arose in the 1970s. And that's when we realized the conversation on climate change had to be reinvented. It was because it was always seen as a topic in science, or it was seen as something that was very technical. But when we grew up, we always understood the environment as something, as an aspect of life in itself. And so definitely when we started really seeing a lot of young people more interested in learning about how they could actually take action, even from home or at a young age or really through any medium, that's when we started in 2016 this art festival called Kamalayan, which means awareness in Filipino. And what we wanted to do was use the medium of art and design to advocate for climate and culture, because we understood these two things as intersectional. And I think that's really how we began starting the conversation and reinventing the entire discussion around the climate crisis, instead of approaching it as very detrimental and focused on a lot of heavy, intangible science. We wanted to make it something that people could see and feel and really relate to. And I think that's what's really important in any conversation about climate action.
That's amazing to hear, like, how everything started. Because now, I guess just to give context to some of our listeners, Kids for Kids serves as, like, a platform for the youth to come together and work on projects, as you said, that are centered on the Filipino youth, the environment, and Filipino culture. And it's a very impressive and empowering organization now that has, as you mentioned, started off something small and allowed you to branch into, like, the intersectional issues of climate action and some social injustices as well. So you've mentioned some, like, previous collaborations and the partnerships that you've created through Kids for Kids, but in what ways have you been able to collaborate with others in promoting and contributing to environmental protection?
So I guess one would be, well, the most recent one being our collaboration with For the Future. So it's really nice because when you're in this work, you meet so many people, and so many people across all ages, across all walks of life. And it's really great because you can really collaborate with them, and you're, you know, it's a collaboration built on the passion to change. And so that's what really helps, you know, when we have partnerships with people. So I guess with For the Future, it actually just started. We both posted about collecting donations for the typhoon Raleigh. That hit last year, last November, actually. And then we decided, like, oh, if we're both collecting the nations, let's just, like, join forces. And that actually became, like, a really big drive that we're so thankful for. Like, so many people decided to support our Typhoon Relief Fund. And I guess it was different because what we wanted to do, we didn't want to just, you know, provide immediate relief to these communities. We wanted to provide them sustainable options because it was really hard, like, just because we had no other means, you know, when it came to, like, food, really had to, like, use all that single plastic wrap package food. But so we wanted also to at least give them an option that is very sustainable. So we donated solar lights and water filters and rebuilding materials. And I think it was really great seeing the community and the spirit of Bayanihan coming together all to, you know, donate and collect all, like, these funds for these communities. And we were able to help over 100 barangays across the Philippines, and even up till now we're still doing
I think more than 100.
Yeah, more than 100, but then it was really great because it's actually, I guess a lot of people don't understand also the aftermath of typhoons, that even up till now it's been more than a year and there's so many communities that are still affected, so many still homeless without electricity. And I think that's, again, the biggest wound of the Philippines is that, you know, we have all these typhoons that come and get stronger each year, but then somehow we're never prepared for it. And because these communities aren't really given that long-term, you know, climate resilient solutions that they deserve, especially with climate change again, with the climate changing like more now than ever, I think it's really important that when we talk about relief, it's really something that we should think like long term. And so that's one partnership that we're really thankful for, because it stretches up until now, and I think it will go on because we really are looking towards more long term solutions. When it comes also to environmental protection, we're super thankful to also be partnering up with the LGUs in Siargao.
So that's why I think we've really, I guess, expounded the term collaboration through Kids for Kids. It's because we really have worked directly with young people in the front lines of making a difference, all the way to corporations. And in the same processes, we've made sure that the importance and the value for the partnership and the collaboration and anything done within that is valued, no matter who you're working with, whether it be a frontline community in the brink of collapse because of a typhoon, or whether you're working with a corporation that has millions of pesos in their bank account. I feel like this is a type of collaboration more people need to see, so that we could really create a future that's equitable and sustainable for everyone to live in.
It's great to hear all of your partnerships. You've been definitely very selective and making sure that they're impactful, significant, and collaborative in nature. And so with that, you kind of get like a glimpse of how things could be if everybody just really worked together and pulled in with that Bayanihan spirit. So with all that your organization has achieved and done so far, what future do you envision for Kids for Kids, especially after COP26?
The future of Kids for Kids, I feel like it was actually really funny because while we were at COP, we were just like, wow, like, we're just kind of...
What are we going to do?
Because it's more or less the same thing. Like, we thought, I guess, we had, like, this expectation that when we go to COP, we'll have, like, this awakening or enlightenment that, yeah, like, you know, there's so much hope in the future, la, la, la. Like, if you go back, like, it'd be so great. But again, like, we were just left with, like, we were very overloaded and then also underwhelmed at the same time. And so it just really wanted us more to just like go back home and actually like go back to like working there, because again, we felt so detached from the actual issue. And so with the future of Kids to Kids, like looking at all of it now, we really want to start nationwide teams. And since things are opening up with the pandemic, like we're really excited and we really hope that, you know, bring all our volunteers, you know, to the actual sites where we're conserving the mangroves, or we're, you know, providing communities with, you know, educational booklets together with like UNICEF and SMART, and actually, you know, experience all like the on-ground work that we have been doing for the past 5 years. Cause I guess a lot of people are also so fed up with the entire online activism, which is great, but again, it's overwhelming at times mentally. And so we're really excited that, you know, we can finally hopefully visit all the communities and actually meet with them in person and have that connection with them. And with nationwide teams, really just want Filipino youth outside Manila, because we really believe that, you know, the Philippines is not just Manila, it's everything else. So we're really excited to have that and to start that and to really get like more youth leaders around the country to like step up and actually, you know, be in touch more with the communities that they have there. And so that's what we're really excited about. And hopefully, you know, the pandemic and like all the cases like stay at the really low numbers so we could like continue doing our work.
It's very interesting what you mentioned about your experience arriving at COP and being there, especially from a youth perspective and someone who isn't necessarily an ambassador or a state representative. That's really interesting to hear. So I guess I was about to ask what it was like to be surrounded by like-minded individuals at COP. Well, I guess it doesn't apply to most of the other delegates, but I guess the other people who were protesting on the streets, like, what was it like to be surrounded by that group of people who had the same understanding of the issues as you did, while also representing your fellow Filipinos?
It was actually really empowering. And
that's what we like about our COP experience, all the fringe events outside the conference, where you have all of the youth gather together and actually talk about concrete action points that we should be taking on. And it was so great when we joined as well, like the Youth Climate Strike, because that was really empowering. And you see so many people just standing up for more or less the same advocacy as you. And, you know, it's sad because it'd be so great to have these giant strikes here also in the Philippines. But then again, we're also mentioning, because, you know, there are like people from the West asking like, oh, do you guys do this at home? La, la, la. And I'm like, yeah, sometimes like small, but never this big, because it's really dependent on like which country you're doing it in. Because, you know, for the Philippines, we're really, it's like the number one like unsafe country for environmental defenders and activists as well. So it was really great at least experiencing that. And it's sad that that, you know, speaking up really loudly is a privilege. And so it was really empowering seeing everyone from different countries as well. And we were around six or mm-hmm. seven from the Philippines youth who were there. But yeah, so we really would love actually to see more youth representatives at COP, because that was the like sad part, I guess, of it all, is that our country didn't really prioritize COP or sending youth to COP. Unlike, you know, other countries where they actually have like an official youth delegation, the Philippines didn't have one. And so everyone was just going like, you know, kanyang-kanya, sailing sikap. So, but it was really nice seeing everyone get together, like those who are able to go. It was so nice seeing Filipinos there, especially because those are the people you can relate to. Because when we were at the different conferences, even like some youth, they still have the perspective that, you know, it's a very privileged perspective on climate change, because most of them aren't really exposed, you know, firsthand experiences, especially with strong typhoons and everything. So it's nice that we still have a Filipino community there to kind of relate to. But as well, what we noticed with the youth there is that they know so much more than all the adults and all the panels, which was really funny because they had, you know, so much to say. And it was really great that in every panel that there was a youth speaker, it was nice that what the difference I saw is that they would speak for everyone. These adults would just have that lens of, you know, this Western climate crisis that it will be coming in the next 5 years, the next 10 years. So it's a very empowering experience as well. And very, you felt very united with them in a way, even if you've never really met them.
But what we did notice was that there was a lack in like Asian representation. Yeah,
there
in general
was a really big lack with Asian.
And I feel like what we noticed was that it was because of the way Asian culture is. Like, I feel like
it's very different.
Opposing yeah. how the West is very like, for because again, like, if we look back at colonialism, they have a lot more of a say in things. Like, they aren't afraid of going against the system because they created the system. So for a lot of Western youth, it's very easy for them to go out on the street and strike, protest, say their opinions and not be
sue
afraid.
Sue the government.
Yeah, but for Asian youth, I feel like because the way our culture is very, we're more interior. And so when we do have discussions, like if you notice, like everyone is sometimes even shy to speak up about things unless the general collective is. So you see that a lot in the way, I guess, also Asian youth like sees the climate crisis, and majority of Asian-led work is on ground in communities. Mm-hmm. You have people like Melati Weissen, who started Bye Bye Plastic Bags locally. Even Isa Bartes started hers with the Yangil community in Zambales, Luis Mabulo with cacao farmers. So I feel like a lot of the culture of like the Asian culture, even Filipino culture in itself, Southeast Asian culture, is what affects, I guess, the way we pose ourselves in the climate crisis conversation. And it's really interesting to see the contrasting degrees of the way people kind of put themselves in this conversation. And I really think there has to be more discussion mm-hmm. on strengthening, I guess, Asian perspectives mm-hmm. on the climate crisis, because I feel like there's this whole, like the media is already starting to portray the climate conversation as something Western led, when in reality, it's innately from the global South and from the East that understand really what it's like to live with nature. Like how me and my sister, I'm pretty sure a lot of us grew up going to the beach, walking in the forest, understanding what our natural world is. And it's super innate to the point that where we don't see it as like a singular entity, because to us, it's part of our everyday.
So I definitely feel like that's the conversation that has to start becoming a little bit more louder and inclusive for people so that we could really actually create climate action that is related to our culture.
It's because for us, the consequences of the climate crisis have become so normalized. Like, since I was born, there have been typhoons. Like, as far as I can remember, like, we'd always have typhoons, giant storms. Like, that was normal. Seeing people, you know, impoverished people on the streets, like, that's normal. Sadly, unfortunately, in the Philippines, that is normalized when it shouldn't. And so all of these things that for the West, it's like they get so angry and stuff like that because it's only happening to them now. Our initial reaction is we're just going to act on it right away. Like, it's not like we're going to like get mad at the government or get mad at authority because we already understand that that's not going to work for us. So our initial reaction is really just to act on it right away. And so that's why I also compare like with the West, like there's so many activists who are young, but they're mostly on the policy or the talking or the striking side. Whereas when we look at the activists in Asia, we're all doing on-ground work. Most of them have organizations. Most of them really work directly with the communities, which is great. And so we see like the difference between how activism is in different countries, or if you compare in general the global South and the global North, and seeing how the culture really raised them to kind of defend the environment in different ways. And I think it's also an important conversation to bring up because it's very overlooked because, you know, the West is so loud. So a lot of people think that the crisis was led by them, where it was actually all these solutions, like regenerative solutions that the West is talking about that's new or whatever, has been in our culture, even in the Philippines, for as long as we can remember. Like our indigenous people, it's innate in our culture to have like these regenerative practices, even in Africa and things like that. And that's what isn't being brought up, and that's something that needs to be highlighted, which is great because now like people are recognizing that indigenous people should be leading all like these movements. But I feel like we should also focus not only on the indigenous people of the West, but also the indigenous people of the South and of Asia, because those are the ones who really also knew how to live the environment. We all have different ways of dealing with it since we all have different cultures. And so that was like a different perspective that we also got during the conference, how it's really culture in the end that's really going to save us and save our entire world, actually, and the different perspectives that the youth have on tackling this entire crisis.
I guess that was the main highlight of your experience, meeting all of these other members of the youth and learning more, expanding your own perspectives. So it could be someone said that you felt underwhelmed by how the actual leaders and state representatives went about the whole thing. So, but looking at the things that were done by our state representatives, some of the accomplishments include the revisions made in the Santiago Network, which is a platform that means to provide technical assistance to developing countries affected by natural calamities and climate risks. And two Filipinos were involved in pushing forward some of the interventions. And given what you've mentioned about the lack of resiliency when it comes to bouncing back from actual climate disasters and actually having solid disaster risk reduction methods, how did it feel to listen to Filipino representatives talk about this relevant issue in our country?
One of the main discussion points within the conference itself was this whole idea of loss and damage. And I think that directly correlates to what's happening in our country because there's so much of it. I think this was the first time I understood loss and damage at a bigger scale and how vital it was for accountability for bigger countries to actually be accountable for the cost of the crisis because of fossil fuel subsidies and really see how they could come in and help, because that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to really assist developing countries through the loss and damage fund. Unfortunately, even if in the Paris Agreement 5 years ago, it was stated that within the next 5 years, they would be establishing this loss and damage fund, developed countries would be held accountable, thus needing to pool together $100 billion to be able to fund developing countries and to stabilize, I guess, all the issues that were caused because of the crisis. Unfortunately, that wasn't put together in time for COP26. And now again, it's pushed back to COP27. So I feel like seeing these discussions happen like in real time was a little bit heartbreaking. It's because we've waited, for example, like 5 years for things to kind of move on this. And yet when we get to that point, even if it's a year delayed, we still aren't moving forward with that. And so I definitely think for a lot of the Filipinos that were there, even especially those that are familiar with legislative processes, like the lawyers and those that have and were really part of like the negotiation tables, for them it was very difficult to kind of put a say in anything, because again, it always went back to if we could even afford it. Like, for example, in the NDCs, or the nationally determined contributions of the Philippines to the Paris Agreement, it stated that I think we're supposed to kind of be at reduce 70 some percent of our carbon by 2030, I think. Unfortunately, out of the 70 some percent, only 2% of it is unconditional, meaning on our own, solely as a nation, we can reduce 2% of that. But for the rest of it, we need outside and external funding. So I think that's really why I feel like the conversation on accountability has to be strengthened, especially even if I feel like, again, in Asian culture, we're always afraid to kind of like ask and tell people that we need this. I feel like when it comes to the loss and damage aspect of this conversation, I think it really needs to be strengthened and justified further, because I definitely feel like all these developed countries are afraid to contribute to the fund, because the minute they do, it's like, okay, yeah, we understand it. It's our fault for doing this, right? So I just feel like there's, again, a level of like greed almost, to the point where people don't want to take accountability because they don't want to be held responsible again. So there's really big, long discussion and debate on loss and damage. And I think it's a really nice topic that you were able to like bring up in this conversation.
Yeah, and I guess it was also good that our country or their representatives in the COP intervened. But obviously we wish that they negotiated a bit more, which is okay, I guess.
And most of those negotiating weren't from, like, what we would hear about, weren't from even the official Philippine delegation.
Wasn't. There was really a lack. Okay, even in the Philippine delegation, there was the biggest lack of communication, because usually official Philippine or official country delegations are supposed to communicate with the NGOs or like the different participating bodies coming from the same country about their agenda, so that we can all stay uniform in the agenda why we're in the conference. It was so hard to schedule a meeting with them, first of all, and it was so hard to reach them. They didn't really want to even like meet us in the first place. It was really hard because like some people actually did meet them, but then again, it was very unproductive, the meeting. And so that's why it was so hard, because like there are a good amount of Filipinos there, but we all had different agendas. And that's why it hurt, because it was like, wow, if we were just united, if like our actual Philippine delegation united all of us there to have this one agenda, because none of us knew what the official Philippine delegation's agenda was. And even some people part of the delegation didn't even know their agenda as well. And it was just kind of sad hearing that, because it was like, we're the second most vulnerable to this crisis. And most of the people here don't even know why our country is here, what exactly the target or the concrete aim of them being here was. So what we really hope that maybe if we even attend like the next COP, that there really is a solid one uniform agenda for the Philippine delegation, and that our country actually takes these conferences very seriously. Because, you know, no one from the Climate Change Commission was even there. The delegation was filled mostly with Department of Finance people and a few negotiators. But other than that, there was really a lack of representation, which we feel should be really important given that we are a developing country who are facing the worst consequences.
So I guess in some ways it is kind of disappointing to hear that the Philippine delegation, which should have had this conference as a very urgent matter, as a very big priority, didn't seem to feel the urgency of it all. So most of the things that the Philippines did, according to the news in COP, was they pledged to end deforestation by 2030, and they also presented a sustainable finance roadmap. You kind of touched on this earlier, but do you think there were other specific environmental issues that the Philippine delegation could have brought up in delegations or participated in those specific conversations?
There are so many, I feel like, that could be mentioned. But with regards to loss and damage, for me, that would be the most crucial, because that's what we need. We need funding to be able to actually push forward for all these like quote-unquote expensive things we need to do to save our climate. But I definitely feel like there also has to be more talk just in general about our Philippine indigenous people. I feel like sometimes the government or society in the Philippines in general see them as like a separate civilization, which I feel like we need to get rid of. There has to be some way to connect the global community to these indigenous people on ground. Sometimes we forget to view them that they're actual people too. Like, they have opinions, they can form solutions. And that is the type of conversation that I wish our government put more importance in, because obviously everything that has to do with the climate has to be human rights based approach. And unfortunately, when it comes to indigenous people's rights here in the Philippines, it's one of the most difficult topics to even touch on. So I think that conversation has to be strengthened in the Philippine context. And we have to already push forward with seeing how highly intellectual our indigenous people are and how we can actually put them in the forefront of these conversations if we empower them enough.
In addition to that, what they released after COP again was very, it was great, like end deforestation by 2030, sustainable roadmap. But then again, these are all just statements that they're saying. And there's such a lack of execution and implementation and anything that comes out from the Philippine government, because we have the most laws that to protect our environment in the Philippines, in ASEAN, but none of them are being implemented. So they can write anything they want, they can say anything they want, but if there's no proper execution or implementation, it's just sad, because again, we just failed our people. And so even if they say that they're going to end deforestation by 2030, they have a stable financial roadmap. There's so many roadmaps that already have been made. And so it's really just saying, like, or asking them, like, okay, what's the step-by-step process that you will do and you will follow?
I think they also lack the idea of how the environment and climate action also touches on intersectional issues. So what issues in the country do you think would be greatly helped alongside climate action?
I feel like, well, a lot of the reasons why what we get a lot is when we're like, oh, we guys have to focus on the climate crisis and solutions. So we say, like, we can't do that. We have to focus on poverty first. We have to focus on giving people food. We have to focus on proper education. And that's the thing. Like, they don't realize that solutions towards a climate crisis are really, they go hand in hand with all like these human rights problem. And so what we hate especially is when their solution towards whether it be poverty or anything, it always is these band-aid solutions. Like, okay, you can have 1,000 feeding programs, but if it's not sustainable, if it isn't giving farmers the actual funds they need in order to properly grow their crops, not in an industrial way, but in a really regenerative way that doesn't affect the environment and actually grows more proper nutritious food. And if we actually fix the supply chain, make it more accessible to the people who actually need food, then we're going to get nowhere. And I feel like that's the problem, is that they don't see that connection. And that helping that, especially helping agriculture, and if we follow regenerative practices and make it more sustainable in a way, that will actually benefit not only the environment, but also the people. And so that's already putting, you know, food on people's tables. And when it comes to as well, typhoon relief, when they're like, we have to focus on, you know, giving these people, you know, rebuilding. But then again, if we rebuild the same houses that were destroyed by the same typhoons, then we're just going to keep on rebuilding and rebuilding. And it was so sad, because I'm not sure if you know her, Marianelle, and she's a Yolanda survivor, and she's also a really big activist for the Philippines. She was at COP26 and she gave so many amazing talks, and so you're able to chat with her, and she even said that, you know, the people there in her community, they're so tired of rebuilding. And that's the thing, like, we can have all like these orgs come and do mass housing, but if the mass housing isn't suitable for our climate, more so it's not even climate resilient, then again, we're not giving them, the people, the housing that they need in order to live properly. And we're also giving them houses that can collapse when the floods or the typhoons get worse. And so these things are so really interconnected with the climate crisis, because it's solutions to try to prevent and combat that. Things like that really connect towards all of these big things that, you know, these people say that they're trying to prevent, but it's really just not working, because we've been doing that for the past years and people are just getting poorer, the climate is just getting worse. We already see that it's not working. And so hopefully there is a way that they see we need to have more long-term solutions and long-term nature-based and human rights solutions, so that we can both hit climate and social justice at the same time.
So we're nearing the end of the interview with just a few more questions. As youth leaders, what do you think is the role of the Filipino youth in advocating and enacting climate action?
I definitely think the Filipino youth brings a brand new perspective into the conversation, and it's always necessary to include the next generation, especially because, I mean, everyone knows it is our future that's being talked about. So it's just normal to include those that matter the most into the conversation, which are young people. So even I think it would be interesting to go beyond youth, but even children, because again, they view the world very as it is and as it could be as well. So getting their perspective and understanding also how you could actually teach already young people, like as kids, and seeing how they grow up with compassion. And I definitely feel like this is what's possible, and that we see within the Filipino youth today is that we really have a strong sense of community that we need to talk about more, and that we need to foster through kind of disregarding this whole idea of like social classes, and because someone speaks English and that she doesn't understand the pain of those in the front lines, and because someone in the front lines can't explain themselves in English doesn't mean they're any less intellectual. There's this really big gap still in a lot of the ways people approach like climate action that I personally see in the conversation that we have to get rid of, because there's no perfect definition of what an Filipino environmentalist or young youth activist is. I feel like that's what makes it more exciting. There's so much hope in this whole realm of Filipino climate action, and that we can really excitingly take so many different approaches towards it, because again, our culture is so rich. There's so much development in what we can do for it.
Okay, to the very last question. How do you think the voice of the Filipino youth could be further amplified in critical conversations about the environment?
I feel like there has to be like a bridge or a dialogue created between all these different big stakeholders that, for example, environmental lawyers, policymakers, people that have been doing this for their profession the past 70 years, and as well, passing this down on to younger generations. I think it's super important that we have that exchange in all of this. It's because, again, when we talk about the climate, sometimes we don't see the action we're creating in the time span of our life. And that's what we've heard a lot of from like other environmental people that have been doing this for a really, really long time. And they always tell us how tiring it is, because sometimes you really don't get to see the change within your lifetime. But that's why there has to be this whole thing where we are able to transfer the knowledge down, even as young as we are. So as now, like Filipino youth activists or Filipino youth that are involved in environmentalism or just even want to understand it, there always has to be a thought about how you're already creating your legacy and how this legacy can be passed down already onto the next generation. And I think that's what we started out doing with Kids for Kids at the very first stage. Again, the idea wasn't to create an organization, but it was to figure out how we could transfer this concept of kids giving back to other kids to see how those kids could quadruple that effect. Like it was kind of just seeing how we could do like an exponential growth on how we grew the movement. And that's what other youth activists, I think, can do. Like they can really also learn from other young people on ground and also other people that are professional, quote unquote professional in the field, and see how they could bridge that for action. And that round table, that there has to be, instead of a linear discussion, a round table discussion on how we could really make sure that whatever action is being created at the top, it trickles down to the bottom. And from the bottom, we get the solutions from the grassroots communities, and that's amplified at the top at a larger scale. So we can really get things moving in terms of trying to save our planet and our people as well, and most especially our culture.
And yeah, so it's really just not really amplifying people's voices, but also passing them the mic. When it comes to the Filipino youth, There's like this entire stigma where like, oh, you have to be environmentalist, you have to, but I think, you know, we shouldn't put labels on wanting to save the world or saving our country as well, because I feel like as humans, that's a very human thing, you know, like we really just want to save each other. And just knowing that if you have a passion, that can benefit someone else, and just having a compassionate willingness to kind of give back. I feel like anyone who actually does that, even if you just change at least one person's life, you're already making a difference and making a change. And I feel like that's really important. And so with that, I feel like we should not gatekeep, okay, these people, these selective youth will be the ones speaking up, or these. No, I think it's everyone, and anyone doing any small act that should be amplified or should be empowered. And we should just all uplift each other and all pass each other the mics.
On that note, thank you, Tasha and Bella, for joining us in this important conversation. We applaud you both for the work you are doing with and for the youth and climate action. Alongside your mission, we hope that more concrete steps are taken to address the climate crisis, both locally and globally. Once again, thank you, and we wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors as you continue to make waves for the people and planet.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
That's all for this episode of On Point, the Guidon's podcast arm where we sit down and talk with the experts on issues in and beyond Loyola. Special thanks to our executive producers Samantha Onglatko and Martin Ramos, as well as our producers Tatiana L. Maligro, Andrea Micaela Llanes, Neil R. Reyes, and Beatriz C. Reyes. This episode was edited by Yanni Francisco. Our cover art is by Tiffany Ku, and our theme music is brought to you by Vivid Productions. This has been Aliyah Tuprio. Thank you for going On Point with us.